Imagine like breaking your arm. You know, you get an X-ray, the doctor points to a clean white line on the film and says, "There's the break. It's entirely binary."
Right. It's broken or it's not broken.
Exactly. You fix it and you just move on. But, well, what if the medical treatment that absolutely saves your life comes with this devastating invisible cost?
Yeah, that's the harsh reality for patients receiving certain modern medical treatments, specifically the heavy hitters in oncology, like platinum-based chemotherapies. The survival rate is a massive triumph, obviously.
Right.
Like testicular cancer treated with these platinum drugs has an astonishing 99% cure rate. But for many of those patients, the hidden cost of surviving the cancer is, well, it's permanent deafness.
Which is just, I mean, it's entirely unfair. It's like having a firefighter break down the front door of your house with an axe, you know, just to save the building from burning to the ground.
That's a great way to put it, actually.
The fire is out, the house is saved, but the structural damage to the doorway is permanent. And well, that is our mission for this deep dive. We are taking the stack of sources you provided and venturing into the invisible battleground of ototoxicity.
Which literally translates to ear poisoning, by the way.
Ear poisoning.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, so we're going to explore how audiologists are acting as medical detectives to catch this damage before a patient even notices, the cutting-edge chemical shields being developed to protect our ears during chemo, and like the sci-fi level biological therapies aiming to restore hearing once it's completely lost.
It's a huge topic, and to really grasp the stakes here, we first have to define that core term, ototoxicity. It is simply the property of being toxic to the ear, specifically damaging the cochlea or the auditory nerve.
And sometimes the vestibular system too, right?
Yes, exactly, which is what controls your sense of balance. And the primary culprits doing this damage, they fall into a few distinct categories. We just mentioned the platinum coordination complexes, like cisplatin, used for aggressive tumors.
But it's not just cancer drugs.
No, not at all. Beyond oncology, severe bacterial infections are often treated with aminoglycoside antibiotics, drugs like gentamicin and kanamycin. They are incredibly effective, but unfortunately, highly ototoxic.
Right.
Then you have loop diuretics. Those are used to treat heart failure by modifying the fluid balance in your kidneys, but they inadvertently disrupt the delicate fluid balance inside the inner ear as well.
And if you're listening to this thinking, well, this only applies to rare hospital-grade Javi drips, it really doesn't. Some of these culprits might be sitting in your medicine cabinet right now. I mean, the materials specifically call out NSAIDs.
Yeah, everyday over-the-counter aspirin, high doses of it can actually induce ototoxicity.
That's wild.
If you've ever taken like a really large dose of aspirin for a terrible headache and suddenly heard a faint ringing in your ears, you've actually experienced a mild form of ototoxicity firsthand.
Oh, wow. So that ringing is literally ear poisoning.
Essentially, yes. But the crucial difference is that aspirin-induced hearing loss and tinnitus are generally reversible. Once your body clears the drug, your hearing returns to normal. The damage from the heavy-duty drugs like cisplatin and those aminoglycoside antibiotics, that's typically permanent.
Right. And because we are dealing with life-threatening emergencies, aggressive cancers, system-wide infections, we obviously cannot just stop using these life-saving drugs. I mean, the patient desperately needs them to survive.
Exactly. You can't just pause the chemo.
So the first line of defense isn't replacing the medication, it's monitoring the unseen damage. We have to catch it before the patient even realizes their hearing is slipping away.
And that brings us to the foundational concept of baseline testing. You absolutely cannot measure hearing loss if you don't know where the patient started. Pre-existing hearing loss is incredibly common in the general population.
So if you don't test first, you're flying blind.
Completely blind. Without a solid baseline established before treatment begins, an audiologist can't definitively say if a sudden drop in hearing is from the chemotherapy or if it was just already there from, say, going to too many loud concerts.
So ideally, this baseline is recorded before a single drop of the ototoxic drug enters the patient's veins.
Ideally, yes.
But medical emergencies rarely wait for a convenient audiology appointment, right? I mean, a patient crashing in the ER with a lethal infection needs an antibiotic like kanamycin immediately, not tomorrow.
True, but that is where the specific biological quirks of these drugs become a tactical advantage. Kanamycin actually has a bizarre pharmacological delay.
Really? How so?
It generally does not cause demonstrable, measurable damage to the cochlea for at least 72 hours after it is administered.
Oh, wow. So you have a window.
Exactly. Audiologists have this incredibly tense 2-day grace period. They can rush into the hospital ward and get a valid baseline test while the antibiotic is already circulating in the patient's bloodstream, knowing it simply hasn't penetrated the inner ear yet to cause cellular damage.
Okay, let's unpack this, the actual testing part. Because my understanding of a standard hearing test is pretty basic. You sit in a soundproof booth, wear chunky headphones, raise your hand when you hear a faint beep, and that process maps your hearing up to about 8,000 hertz.
That's the standard, yes.
But standard audiometry completely fails us when it comes to monitoring odor toxicity. Why isn't 8,000 hertz enough?
Well, we have to look at the physical architecture of the inner ear to understand that failure. The cochlea looks almost exactly like a spiraled snail shell. When these toxic drugs enter the ear, the damage almost always begins at the very base of that shell.
The basal turn, right?
Right, anatomically known as the basal turn. And the microscopic outer hair cells located in this specific basal region are responsible for detecting the absolute highest frequency sounds. So as the drug seeps in, it starts destroying the cells from the base upward.
Meaning the very highest registers of hearing are the first to die off?
Exactly. The initial destruction happens far above the 8,000 hertz limit of human speech. It begins long before the damage creeps down the spiral into the lower frequencies we rely on for normal conversation.
So it's silent damage.
It is. If a clinic only tests up to 8 kilohertz, the chemotherapy could be silently, permanently destroying the upper registers of a patient's hearing for weeks, and neither the patient nor the doctor would have any idea until it was far too late.
Let me push back on this for a second, though. If a patient is fighting a grueling life or death battle against an aggressive cancer, why are we prioritizing high frequency hearing?
Fair question.
I mean, these are dog whistle registers that most adults barely use anyway. Does it really matter to a cancer survivor if they lose the ability to hear a bat squeak or a mosquito buzz?
It's a highly pragmatic question, yeah. But the reality is, the primary goal of detecting that ultra-high frequency loss isn't just about saving the ability to hear a bat squeak.
Yeah.
It functions as an early warning system.
Mm, okay.
It tells the oncologist, the fire has officially started inside the ear. By catching the cellular death in those uppermost frequencies, the physician gains critical lead time.
Time to do what, exactly?
They might be able to carefully lower the drug dosage or switch the patient to a slightly less toxic platinum alternative, like carboplatin, before the damage descends down the cochlea into the speech frequencies.
Mm.
The ultimate overarching goal is preserving the patient's ability to communicate clearly. We want to prevent a severe social handicap and protect their quality of life for the decades after they beat the cancer.
Got it. So to catch that early warning, audiologists use high-frequency audiometry, or HFA, testing all the way up to 16,000 or even 20,000 hertz.
Right.
But behavioral testing, like asking someone to raise their hand when they hear a beep, requires a cooperative alert patient. If the patient is a frightened 2-year-old or someone drifting in and out of consciousness in the ICU, a booth test is just useless.
Completely useless. So for young children or severely ill patients, the field relies on a stunning piece of objective technology called otoacoustic emissions, or OAEs.
How does that work?
The audiologist places a tiny soft probe into the ear canal that emits a series of clicks or tones. What happens next is remarkable. Healthy outer hair cells in the cochlea respond to that sound by physically vibrating.
Like they move.
Yes. And this vibration actually produces an echo, a faint literal sound that travels back out of the ear. The probe has a microscopic microphone that measures that outgoing echo.
That's crazy.
If the hair cells are dying from the chemotherapy, they stop vibrating. The echo disappears. The audiologist gets a perfect map of cellular health without the patient needing to lift a finger or say a single word.
Wait, so the ear isn't just a passive microphone receiving sound? It's actively acting like a tiny speaker, singing an echo back to us.
Exactly. It's an active mechanical process.
That is incredible. But OAEs sound almost too perfect. No patient response needed, just measuring the ear's own biological echo. So why don't we just use them for everyone? There has to be a catch if we're dealing with very sick, immunocompromised cancer patients.
There is a catch. The Achilles heel of an OAE test is the middle ear. Because the test relies on capturing a microscopic, incredibly delicate sound bouncing back out through the eardrum, any kind of physical blockage ruins the reading.
Oh, like fluid.
Right. Cancer patients undergoing heavy chemotherapy have severely depressed immune systems. They are highly prone to otitis media middle ear infections. Fluid builds up behind the eardrum.
And that blocks the echo.
Exactly. That fluid acts like a brick wall for the tiny echo, completely disrupting the OAE reading, even if the inner ear hair cells are perfectly healthy.
So an audiologist has to be incredibly adaptable, running a whole battery of different tests to navigate around whatever physical limitations the patient presents on any given day.
It's constant problem solving, yeah.
And when they finally get clear data, they don't just guess if things are getting worse. They rely on strict, standardized criteria. The gold standard referenced in our sources here is the 1994 ASHA criteria.
Right, the American Speech Language Hearing Association.
Yeah, and it dictates that a significant change requires either a 20 decibel drop at any one single frequency or a 10 decibel drop at two adjacent frequencies. That is the exact mathematical threshold where the alarm bells ring.
And when those alarm bells do ring, the audiologist alerts the medical team.
Mm-hmm.
But quite often, the oncologist has to make a grim calculation. They might look at the scans and say, we see the hearing loss, but the tumor is too aggressive. We cannot stop the cisplatin. We have to keep pushing.
Man, so monitoring is no longer enough at that point. I mean, knowing the house is burning down doesn't put out the fire.
Right.
And this brings us to one of the most exciting breakthroughs in this deep dive, the chemical shield, proactive otoprotectants.
This is where the science gets really amazing. To understand how a chemical shield protects the ear, we first have to understand the microscopic weapon attacking it. When ototoxic drugs like cisplatin or those aminoglycosides enter the inner ear, they interact with ambient metals and biomolecules.
And that causes a reaction.
Yes. This interaction creates volatile molecules called reactive oxygen species, or ROS.
I always hear that term in expensive skincare commercials. You know, it's usually branded as free radicals causing oxidative stress.
It is exactly the same underlying chemistry, but supercharged and concentrated. Inside the highly delicate hair cells of the cochlea, this explosion of oxidative stress is absolutely lethal.
It just shreds the cell.
It damages the cell's internal machinery so severely that it triggers a biological process called apoptosis.
Apoptosis.
Yeah, the cell essentially recognizes it is fatally compromised and executes a programmed cellular suicide.
So if reactive oxygen species are like microscopic sparks flying off the chemo drug inside the ear, taking an antioxidant shield is like preemptively spraying the inside of the cochlea with fire retardant.
That's a perfect analogy.
And there is a massive breakthrough detailed here in our sources. A drug called PEDMARK, which is a specialized sodium thiosulfate injection, it was recently FDA approved specifically for pediatric patients from 1 month old and up who are battling localized non-metastatic solid tumors.
The pharmacological mechanics of PEDMARK are brilliant because it fights the ototoxicity on two distinct fronts.
Okay, how does it do that?
First, in the bloodstream, it interacts directly with the circulating cisplatin, aggressively binding to it and mutating it into an inactive platinum species that is completely harmless to the ear.
Wow. And the second front?
Second, it operates at the cellular level. It enters the auditory cells through a highly specific chemical doorway called the sodium sulfate cotransporter 2. Once inside, it drastically boosts the cell's internal levels of glutathione.
Which is an antioxidant, right?
Yes, one of the body's most powerful natural antioxidants. So it neutralizes the chemo drug floating outside the cell and puts out the oxidative fire raging inside the cell.
But the timing of this drug is like a tense Hollywood thriller. I mean, imagine you're a parent of a toddler undergoing this treatment, just watching the clock tick down. PEDMARK must be administered exactly 6 hours after the cisplatin infusion.
Exactly 6 hours, no sooner, no later.
Right. If you give it too early, the PEDMARK binds to the cisplatin before it has a chance to kill the cancer, effectively shielding the tumor itself.
Which is the last thing you want.
But if you give it too late, say 10 hours after the chemo, those oxidative sparks have already triggered apoptosis, the hair cells are already dead, and the hearing loss is irreversible. You have this incredibly tight 6-hour window to apply the fire retardant before the house burns down.
It perfectly highlights the extreme, unforgiving precision required in modern pharmacology. But PEDMARK is just the vanguard. The pipeline for these protective drugs is expanding rapidly. For example, there is Epsilon, an oral medication currently being studied.
Right, and the sources say Epsilon mimics something called glutathione peroxidase. What does that actually mean for the cells in our ear?
Glutathione peroxidase is a natural enzyme. Think of it as a cellular housekeeper. Its primary job is to sweep up toxic hydrogen peroxide inside our cells and safely convert it into water.
Okay, that sounds helpful.
It is. But during chemotherapy, the housekeeper gets completely overwhelmed by the oxidative stress. Epsilon is a synthetic organoselenium compound that acts as a stand-in housekeeper. It artificially boosts the ear's ability to clear out that toxic buildup before apoptosis is triggered.
There is another investigational drug in the pipeline that fascinated me, SCNS-401, also known as erazacitran besalate. The parent drug, azacitran, is actually an anti-nausea medication commonly used to help patients stomach chemotherapy.
Right. SCNS-401 is an isolated part of that anti-nausea molecule, specifically what chemists call the R enantiomer.
Wait, you said R enantiomer.
Yeah.
For those of us listening who haven't taken an organic chemistry class in a while, what does that actually mean? Is it like a structural mirror image of the molecule that just happens to protect the ear instead of treating nausea?
That is a perfect way to visualize it. Complex molecules often have left-handed and right-handed versions. They share the same chemical formula but are structural mirror images.
So they do different things in the body.
Exactly. The parent drug might be great at stopping nausea, but this specific handed version, SCNS-401, behaves differently. As an investigational orphan drug, it is showing immense promise, not just for preventing cisplatin-induced hearing loss, but also for treating acoustic trauma.
Oh, like from loud noises.
Yeah, it could potentially protect the inner ear from severe noise damage, like a blast injury. We are rapidly moving into an era where we don't just passively monitor ototoxic damage, we proactively deploy pharmacological armor.
But human biology is messy. What happens when the armor fails? I mean, despite our best monitoring, despite perfectly timed six-hour injection windows, sometimes a patient's unique metabolism overrides the protection. Or the treatment window is missed entirely.
It happens, unfortunately.
This results in postlingual deafness, meaning the patient loses their hearing after they have already grown up and learned to speak. How do we pull them back into the hearing world?
Well, for the last few decades, the medical fallback has been the cochlear implant, or CI. It is a fundamental shift in approach. Instead of just amplifying sound like a traditional hearing aid, a CI physically bypasses the dead hair cells entirely.
It's an implant, so it's surgical.
Right. An array of tiny electrodes is surgically threaded into the cochlea to directly stimulate the auditory nerve with electrical impulses.
The sources included a really compelling Iranian study looking at the outcomes of cochlear implants, specifically in 50 postlingually deaf patients. The data showed that while CIs unequivocally improve hearing, the results are wildly variable. You get the best, most articulate results if the patient is relatively young at the time of the surgery, if they were younger when the deafness originally started, and if there were absolutely no surgical complications.
And on the flip side, underlying systemic health conditions like diabetes or hypertension significantly lower the degree of improvement.
Why is that? What do blood pressure and blood sugar have to do with the ear?
Those systemic conditions, diabetes and high blood pressure, chronically damage the tiny, fragile blood vessels that feed oxygen to the auditory nerve. If the nerve itself is compromised by poor blood flow, the electrical impulses from the implant won't be transmitted cleanly to the brain.
I do want to bring up a seeming contradiction in that study's data that made me pause, actually.
Oh, what did you notice?
The study showed that patients who used hearing aids prior to getting their cochlear implant actually had higher, meaning worse, absolute hearing thresholds post-surgery.
Right.
But then, in the very next breath, it says those who used hearing aids for a longer duration before surgery showed the highest functional improvements. How does that contradiction make sense? How can you have worse thresholds but better improvement?
It's a fantastic catch. And the answer lies in understanding neuroplasticity versus pure mechanical sensitivity.
Okay, break that down for us.
Well, the threshold is the absolute softest physical sound a person can detect. Patients who relied heavily on hearing aids for years before finally opting for surgery likely had very profound, difficult-to-treat deafness to begin with. Hence, there's slightly worse absolute thresholds even after the implant. However, improvement measures the developmental jump from where they started to where they ended up.
So it's about what the brain does with the sound, not just the ear.
Precisely. When a person goes deaf, the auditory processing centers in the brain don't just sit empty. They start to atrophy or get repurposed. By using hearing aids for a long duration, even if the sound coming through was heavily garbled and completely unintelligible, those patients kept their auditory pathways active.
Like exercising a muscle.
Exactly. They kept the auditory nerve warm, holding onto that real estate in the brain. When the clear electrical signal from the cochlear implant was finally turned on, their brain was already primed and practiced at processing auditory input, leading to a much more dramatic leap in functional day-to-day improvement.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because as life-changing as cochlear implants are, they are still just a mechanical workaround. They are not true biological hearing. The implant is ultimately a sophisticated microphone wired directly into your nervous system.
Right, it's a prosthesis.
And there is a heartbreaking evolutionary quirk at play here. Unlike birds and unlike amphibians, mammals cannot spontaneously regenerate sensory cells in the cochlea. If a songbird is deafened by an incredibly loud noise, its ear simply regrows the microscopic hair cells.
It's amazing.
But if a human loses them to chemotherapy, they are gone forever.
Which is exactly why the true holy grail of audiology isn't building a better robotic implant. It is achieving true biological restoration. The goal is to teach the human ear to act like an avian ear. And the key to unlocking this lies in gene therapy, specifically targeting a master gene known as ATOH1.
So ATOH1 is less like a piece of biological hardware and more like a biological foreman.
That's a great analogy. ATH1 is the master transcription factor that controls the differentiation of hair cells during fetal development. When you're growing in the womb, this foreman is shouting orders, telling generic cells to become specialized auditory hair cells.
But then it stops.
Yeah, once a mammal is born, that foreman clocks out. The switch flips off permanently. Experimental gene therapies, such as a treatment known as CGF-166, are currently being tested in human clinical trials to wake that foreman back up.
How do you actually get the foreman back inside the closed-off inner ear?
They use a harmless genetically engineered virus as a delivery vehicle. Viruses are naturally brilliant at breaking through cell walls and injecting genetic material.
So they hack the virus.
Exactly. Scientists simply hollow out the harmful, infectious part of a virus and pack it with copies of the ATH1 blueprint. They inject this viral vector directly into the inner ear. The goal is to force the existing dormant supporting cells in the cochlea to read the ATH1 blueprint and physically transform into brand new, biologically functioning hair cells.
It is absolute science fiction becoming reality. And these cellular interventions aren't just about restoring hearing loss, right? Because ototoxicity frequently brings along a passenger. Severe, intractable tinnitus, that constant maddening ringing in the ears. There is a drug mentioned called Kieselin or AM101 targeting this.
Yes. Tinnitus triggered by ototoxicity is intensely neurological. As the chemotherapy destroys the auditory cells, the dying auditory nerve begins firing wildly. It's an aberrant nerve excitation mediated by specific chemical doorways in the brain called NMDA receptors.
Can we translate that? What does an aberrant nerve excitation actually look like for the patient?
Imagine a sophisticated car alarm that starts glitching and blaring simply because the internal wires are melting. The auditory nerve is firing continuous panic distress signals to the brain as it sustains damage.
That sounds agonizing.
It is. Kieselin is an NMDA receptor antagonist. It specifically blocks those chemical doorways in the brain from receiving the panic signals. By administering it during the acute phase of hearing loss, it essentially cuts the wire to the glitching car alarm, trying to silence the ringing before the brain becomes permanently rewired to expect that phantom sound.
It is truly staggering how fast and how far this field is moving. We started this deep dive looking at a terrible binary paradox. A drug that miraculously saves your life but irreversibly takes your hearing. We explored the meticulous detective work of audiologists using high-frequency tests and the magical echoes of otoacoustic emissions to catch the damage before it drops into the frequencies of human speech.
And the chemical shields.
Right. We looked at how brilliant pharmacology like PEDMARK acts as a chemical fire retardant to halt cellular suicide if administered in a highly specific nerve-wracking 6-hour window. And we've seen how, when prevention fails, cochlear implants provide a powerful mechanical bridge back to the hearing world, while A2H1 gene therapies promise a near future where we might actually regrow the very cells we lost.
It's a lot of hope.
It really is. For you listening, it is a stark reminder that our ears are incredibly fragile, specialized instruments. It underscores the vital importance of being highly aware of the side effects of your medications, even over-the-counter ones like aspirin, and above all, advocating for a baseline hearing test before undergoing major medical treatments. You simply cannot protect what you haven't measured.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the entire paradigm of auditory medicine is undergoing a massive generational shift. We are slowly moving away from an era of simply managing the damage with hearing aids, mechanical implants, and sign language, and stepping into an era where we are actively preventing and eventually reversing deafness at the fundamental molecular and genetic level.
And that leaves us with one final provocative thought to chew on. We discussed how birds and amphibians can naturally regenerate their hearing, which is exactly why scientists are so focused on manipulating that ATOH1 master switch. But think about the long-term implications of that research. If gene therapy successfully unlocked this avian ability in humans to cure deafness caused by chemotherapy, could we eventually engineer our ears to constantly regenerate hair cells throughout our entire lives? Could unlocking this avian trait effectively eliminate age-related hearing loss forever? Imagine a future where a 9-year-old human has the pristine, unbreakable auditory resilience of a songbird. A world where the firefighter can break down the door and the house simply rebuilds itself.